Let me thank the super organizers of this, Michael Ljubic and the others, for inviting me, helping to organize this workshop and talk over here. So this is a summary of work in the last couple of years, done in collaboration with various colleagues and students, among them Christoph Bergbauer, Spencer Bloch, David Bolters, Alan Kohn, Kofi Bremifard, Helene No, Ligu, who are partially here. And I want to speak about various aspects of the fact that when you look at this graphical description of perturbative quantum field theory, we all got used to, namely Feynman graphs, that there's a structure in these Feynman graphs which gives a Lie algebra structure to such graphs, and dually a certain Hopf algebra structure, and that in the best of all worlds, in my opinion, we would have discovered this Hopf algebra structure much earlier, because it would have given much credibility to randomization theory early on, because things like Zimmermann's forest formula are now looking like just an outcome of this Hopf algebra structure. This talk relates in some ways to the previous talk. I will speak about how Dyson-Schwinger equations look from this viewpoint. There are a couple of interesting things you can start doing now, for example, summing up a couple of these equations using information coming from these Hopf and Lie algebras, which in a way which was not possible before. And actually there is one interesting thing happening in gauge theories, which is a very recent result, namely the Slavnov-Taylor identities for the coupling. You can also get from the Hochfeld cohomology actually of these Hopf algebras in a rather cute way, even without knowing much about local gauge symmetry of your classical Lagrangian. And then I will try to find the time to speak about a very hard problem, which also was mentioned in the previous talk, namely the skeleton graphs, which live in the Beta-Salpeter equation. They are intimately related to the primitive elements in this Hopf algebra. And these, so they give randomization group invariant contributions to anomalous dimensions and so on, because they are graphs which have no divergent subgraphs. This implies that these graphs give very interesting numbers, because these numbers do not vary when we change scale of external momenta or any dimensional full quantity in the graph. And these numbers turn out to be mathematically very interesting, and a lot of the hard work of quantum field theory can be described these days in understanding the numbers which come here, which might be numbers like U62 you saw in John Gracie's talk. Understanding these numbers better and understanding better why they come from quantum field theory. And fortunately, very slowly and very painfully, but steady, mathematics seems to give an understanding why these numbers come. We will actually hear, I believe, in Stefan Weinzierl's talk, much more about the plethora of numbers which come, and also we heard something from John Gracie. So after having discovered these Lie and Hopf algebras, my approach to a quantum field theory, which I try to explain, would look like something like the following. There is a pre-Lie algebra on one particle with reducible graphs. Having found this pre-Lie algebra, I just anti-symmetrize my pre-Lie product and get a Lie algebra. And then there's a canonical mathematical step going from this graded pre-Lie algebra to a dual construction which gives me a Hopf algebra. The next interesting thing I want to learn about this Hopf algebra is its Hochfeld cohomology, and this will allow me to write down actually Dyson-Schwinger equations, which I consider as the quantum equations of motion of the quantum field theory. And it is in looking at this Hochfeld cohomology that these primitive skeleton graphs come up and play a very crucial role. Interestingly enough, if you have internal symmetries in your theory, then the typical identities between Green's functions, which we as good perturbative quantum field theorists typically write as identities between graphs, like Ward identities or Slavnov-Taylor identities, relate actually to this Hochfeld cohomology, and I want to say something about that. And then these skeleton things come as one Hochfeld one co-cycle, and they are computational, the hard part, and I will try to finish with some comments on them, mentioning some recent results of two mathematicians and myself, Spencer Bloch and Lenny Noh and myself, where we connected these graphs to motivic theory, which means we understand a bit better why some of these graphs evaluate into zeta values, and we would like to understand it in much more general context to finally be able to solve a Dyson-Schwinger equation once and for all in four dimensions. Well, let me remind you of a couple of... Let me remind you of a couple of basic things which I will address to you in a more systematic way then. If I give you some two-loop graph, let's say Masler's U-curve theory, which has just the nice property that it has a divergent one-loop subgraph, when I calculate it in some regulator, say, like dimensional regularization, I would certainly find that I have a second-order pole, d minus 4 squared, over there. I have a first-order pole, and I have a scaling behavior q squared over mu squared to the twice d minus 4, if this is just a Masler's theory. If I do just the perturbative one-loop exercise, I will find some other only first-order pole and some finite stuff, and this type of dependence on the momentum of it flows through the graph. There's a little bit of information which is non-trivial and comes from the existence of a normalization group, which tells me that this two-loop coefficient over here is just one-half of this one-loop coefficient squared, which is precisely what you need to make the normalization group tick. And when you trace it back to perturbation theory, you get those type of identities. Now, these evaluations of graphs mean I have some final rules phi which you apply to a graph, and they typically give me Laurent series with poles of finite order. If I have a finite loop order in the graphs, then they give me some logs when I expand this in d minus 4. They give me some logs, and but certainly the problem over here is that when I expand this, I will see a log of q squared over mu squared over d minus 4. So there are non-local divergences in this, but I don't have to worry in the recursion which you all know exists in renormalization theory. The Liubert-Szabar operation tells me I have to renormalize the subdivergence. And if I do so, I still get a series with poles of second order. But now when I expand actually in log, log dependence is only in the finite parts. Here the singularities are now completely local. They don't depend on logs of my kinematical variable. And so I can put those counter terms in the Lagrangian, which just remove these things over here. So I have as a very crucial input Bogutyubov-Szabar operation, which gives me a certain contribution of a graph plus the removal of its all its subdivergences, and I know that this produces local counter term. We want to trace these type of combinatorics and also these facts coming from the normalization group back to some Hopf and Lie algebra structure on elements in perturbation theory. Let me quickly summarize what has been done and what I have not the time today to speak about, namely things relating to these Riemann-Hilbert problems. So this is just to remind you that this story started after I basically found this Hopf algebra by me being invited to IGS and running into Alan Kohn and telling him about my Hopf algebra, and he was looking at foliations at the time and found a very similar Hopf algebra governing foliations in diffeomorphisms, and we quickly realized what these Hopf algebras have to do with each other, started working together, and the picture, which I will not speak about today, but which you might wish to look up in the literature, is that you can read renormalization, and is it the composition of unrenormalized quantity, Feynman rules evaluating on something, into a decomposition in a part phi plus, which exists in the Riemann sphere where the variable is a complex regulator in the vicinity of the value of the regulator where you want to know it, namely the dimension of space-time, say, if you use them rec. So somewhere here in the Feynman rules you can invite here evaluate on all closed little circles around that dimension, and the renormalized values exist over here. The counter terms in minimal subtraction, say, exist over here, And you have just a nice little Birkhoff decomposition here with respect to the character group of this Hopf algebra which I want to introduce. This is all published all a couple of years old, and from here and from the kinship of this character group to the diffeomorphism group of actually diffeomorphisms of physical variables, you can actually derive the normalization group and all the standard law of perturbative quantum field theory. The crucial input, though, which will remain crucial for what I want to talk about today, is to understand where in quantum field theory you have a Lie and Hopf algebra structure. So let's be a bit more demanding and start with a quantum field theory which has ingredients which you all know rather well. So say, non-abelian gauge theory, which gives me a propagating free fermion on the free side of the theory. Say I need a ghost, have a gluon, and then I have my four interaction terms. So now I have my local interactions and free propagators given, meaning I know my Feynman rules. With it come a set of one-particle irreducible graphs made up out of these edges and vertices, and I know power counting for those graphs. So I have an idea if they are superficially divergent or not. In principle, what I want to know is I would like to be able to evaluate all those graphs precisely the sum of all graphs with a given external leg structure. So this is either a propagation or a vertex. Graph I always like to divide by its symmetry factor immediately, and each graph has a canonical order and some small constant which we call the coupling, and this is the loop number of the graph. This is, and here I start with a constant after, say, I project the tree-level term by some projection of the structure functions to 1. So now this we would like to evaluate by some by the Feynman rules, that we all know, this is tough business. It gives ultraviolet divergent results for each term in the perturbation series, and it's very hard to sum the series. All right, we will see later on that even this combination of graphs, this linear combination of graphs, has very interesting meaning in this Hopf algebra. But now it's time to really get to work. So here we have such a graph. It has internal edges which connect two vertices. It has some external edges which we can label by quantum numbers, by external momenta, if you like to, and it certainly has vertices in it. On this, you can define in a very elementary way, actually, a pre-Lie structure. The way you do this is you very deeply use that you have a renormalizable theory, which tells me there's only a finite number of external structures which need renormalization. So I'm looking at one particle reducible graphs which have correspond to the vertices or quadratic terms in my Lagrangian and my renormalizable theory. And then I defined a gluing operation which tells me any graph which, for example, is contributing one particle reducible and contributing to the propagation of the gluon here, so it's a self-energy graph, can go into this graph by just looking at all appearances of the gluon propagator in this graph and then replacing the gluon propagator by just this graph. And if there would be more than one propagator, I get a sum of terms and sum over all possible ways of doing this. I can anti-symmetrize this structure and, for example, do it the other way around, which I do in this term. Now I'm summing over all ways of gluing this little guy into here. Now the external leg structure here is a gluon and two fermions. I find two such vertices in here. So each such vertex can be replaced by this one particle reducible vertex collection. Here, accidentally, it happens if I do it here or here, I get the same graph as a result, and so I have a factor 2 over here. The very crucial ingredient which starts this whole business is to realize that this harmless-looking operation star has very interesting structure on it. Namely, A star B, so I'm summing over all weights of gluing B into A, and then take another graph C and glue this, extend everything by linearity, into the result I got before. I subtract from it the leg this bracketing, which immediately tells you that this map is not associative. Here C goes into B first, and the result goes into anal, possible ways. Now, when you think about it, here C can end up sitting in B, which sits in A, or C can end up sitting at a place disjoint to B in A. Here C must end up sitting in B, so in the difference, the contributions which remain are precisely those contributions where B and C go into disjoint places in A. And that, because a sum of all places is symmetric under exchange of C and B, so I get this identity on graphs. Once I have this identity on graphs, this tells me I have a bilinear map which gives to graphs the structure of a Prelie algebra. When I anti-symmetrize a Prelie map, like this map over here, so I do this over here, define this to be the bracket on graphs, then immediately I know from this equation that this will fulfill Jacobi when I use one more commutator and cyclically sum, so I get a Lie algebra structure. Once I have this Lie algebra structure, I can use a bit of mathematics, look at the universal enveloping algebra of this Lie algebra, and use the Milner-Mohr theorem to look at the dual side. That tells me that dually I get a Hopf algebra. And when the Lie algebra was about plugging graphs into each other, the Hopf algebra is about dually taking graphs into subpieces. You can work out, actually, from the Milner-Mohr theorem what this Hopf algebra structure is. What does this Hopf algebra structure tell you? There's a coproduct, which is the most interesting map on a Hopf algebra, which tells you that gamma decomposes into the trivial part, gamma times 1 plus 1 times gamma, plus a sum over all one-particle irreducible subgraphs, possibly disjoint unions of these graphs, which is my product on them, which have external leg structure, meaning they contribute to superficially divergent quantities in my quantum field theory. So these are 1pi subgraphs which fulfill some qualifications. Tensor, the cograph, which I obtain when the subgraph shrinks to a point, or if this is a set of subgraphs, shrinks to various points. So this, actually, this map is co-associative. It establishes a Hopf algebra. There's an antipode on it, which gives you this. Now, Hopf algebras allow for very nice things. In particular, they allow you to take characters on the Hopf algebra. These are maps which map elements in the Hopf algebra into some target space, say a ring or an algebra, so that there is a product on the target space. And then you immediately get the group of characters on the Hopf algebra with values in the target space, because now what you can do is, if you have two such maps, and these two maps fulfill phi of AB is phi of A, phi of B, and similarly for another map psi, then you define psi stars. But psi is multiplication in the target space, application of phi and psi combined with a coproduct. And that gives you a group. That's the purpose of a Hopf algebra. The antipode allows you to define the inverse in this group. And so we have a little group structure in here. Now it turns out that you can define Feynman rules to be such a map in some target space. If you use DIMRAC, that would be the space of Laurent polynomials with poles of finite order, and so on and so forth. And you also want to introduce a randomization scheme in this gap game. So you define yourself an interesting other character, Elsa Phi on Gamma, which is, if R would be the identity map, just with respect to this convolution, the inverse of Phi, but you have here, if R is not the identity map, a map acting on those values, like minimal subtraction, which projects the values of a graph, say, to the pole terms, or whatever your randomization scheme is, and you want your randomization scheme to fulfill this identity, which makes it a Rota-Baxter algebra, and we will hear more about this today. But this identity is strong enough to prove that this map then is also a character on the Hopf algebra, so that you can convolute them. That's the convolution product I just mentioned over here. And then here you regain actually Zimmermann's forest formula. You're precisely saying, when you work this out, what this says, that the randomization of a graph is obtained by constructing the counterterms for all its subgraphs. That's what the coproduct gives you. And then you're essentially saying that once you apply a bar operation, so you subtracted all the subgraphs, a simple overall subtraction under a given renormalization scheme does the job for you. And in this Birkhoff decomposition, Korn and I were speaking about, that would be the phi plus part, that would be the phi minus part. Okay. So here's a little example. Nothing non-trivial happening, but when you work it out, what it is, it precisely tells you when you have the graph, where all subdivergences shrink to a point, so the underlying skeleton, if you like, in which all the subgraphs fit, then what SR phi achieves for you in this formulation is it takes the integral representation of the underlying subgraph and replaces all the integrals for the subdivergences for the subgraphs by their renormalized value, which is precisely what you want a counterterm to be constructed as. So then, well, you just work it out that whatever you do, whatever SR phi star phi is, it will always be in the image of it minus R. And that is the Birkhoff decomposition, really. The renormalized thing is in the image of it minus R, the counter term is in the image of R. And this identity, to say it once more, the Rotha-Baxter identity, actually tells you that the image and the kernel of R give you subalgebras in their own right. All right. Now, the thing you really want to prove in renormalization theory is that counter terms are local. And this, as it turns out, maybe comes from something which is very nice. You can typically, as we will see, write the coproduct in a different way by finding that all graphs have the structure, there's an underlying skeleton graph, and the subproblems, the subgraphs, fit somewhere in the skeleton graph. Now invent yourself a map which, roughly speaking, says I'm gluing into the skeleton graph in all possible ways. So you need maybe a label for the chosen skeleton graph, and I also indicate the external leg structure the skeleton graph has. But this map, gluing all subgraphs to the argument in the underlying primitive thing in all possible ways, commutes with the application of this coproduct in a very interesting way. Namely, it fulfills this formula, which means, from a mathematical viewpoint, that this is a Hochschild closed one co-cycle in this Hopf algebra, and that allows to you, I have a bit more detail on that, that allows to you to prove locality of counterterms in a rather cute fashion. Namely, so all my subgraphs fit in a skeleton. So my graph gamma is the application of some map which puts the subgraph X into the underlying skeleton graph gamma. Now I know that, first of all, I forgot a bar somewhere. That's to use a bar operation. That phi bar of gamma I get by applying the coproduct. Then you can show that to use a bar operation wants a projection into the augmentation ideal of the Hopf algebra on the right-hand side. And then it applies the counterterm character in the final root, and then it multiplies everything together. Now, because this map was Hochschild closed, BB plus gamma equals zero, and it's a non-trivial co-cycle over there, and it's actually, there are not many more than that, which are interesting. We know how it commutes, how delta commutes with B plus gamma, and nicely, because the projection into the augmentation ideal always annihilates the trivial element in your Hopf algebra, so you use this, and also this map ends up in the augmentation ideal, so you have this as well. This all simplifies enormously, and you directly get the Haber operation maps the Feynman rules, which says I have somewhere the evaluation of the subgraphs sitting inside the skeleton to the evaluation of the subgraphs under renormalization sitting inside the skeleton. And we are there. And you can make this into an inductive proof over the augmentation degree of the Hopf algebra to prove locality of counterterms. And that is just what the Hochschild one cocycle does on general maps in the Hopf algebra. So you get a nice little connection between Hochschild cohomology of the Hopf algebra of Feynman graphs And the most crucial input which you require in renormalization theory, namely locality of counterterms. So that's nice. But what's even nicer, in my personal opinion, was that this locality of counterterms and its original Hochfeld cohomology told you something about Dyson-Schwinger equations. In the first way, we observed this was in collaboration with David Protest, but we were looking at, we were just playing with these Hopf algebras to learn more of them. And these Hopf algebras of graphs, they are very easily related to Hopf algebras of rooted tree, and the Hopf algebra of rooted tree is the universal object in here, and maybe I have later a moment to introduce it. But here you see in this nice example a very clean map between Feynman graphs and rooted trees. So assume I give you the sum of all graphs. It has an exercise in Marshall's Jacobi theory, but you can play this exercise. Roughly speaking. Now, the Zimmermann forest would be Actually, we see it, I don't want to draw too much in there. Okay, now we have these things. It's obvious how you map this. For example, this term here, this sum of rooted trees, comes precisely from all for loop graphs which you have in Jacobi theory, using that the evaluation of such a graph is the same as the evaluation of such a graph, so you just can represent it by 2 over here. So we have this nice little Dyson-Schwinger equation, if you like, which says x equals alpha b plus 1 over 1 minus x, where b plus is the operator now, which maps, b plus is the operator now, which maps the product of rooted trees to something like this. You add just a new root above it and connect to the old roots. This is the Hochfeld closed one cocycle in the Hopf algebra of rooted trees. So you also know what is the one cocycle over here. This is a recursive equation which defines an infinite series in alpha with coefficients in the Hopf algebra, and you work it out what it is. So each coefficient of alpha k is a linear combination of Feynman graphs or rooted tree, whatever language you prefer. But now something beautiful happens. Due to the fact that this is a Hochfeld closed one cocycle and everything in this infinite series sits in the image of it, which tells you already you can renormalize everything by local counterterms, it also tells you a little bit more. Namely, if you define a suitable derivation on the Hopf algebra, this is a derivation on the Hopf algebra which takes out, in this case, let me explain it on 3, when I have f of x2, x2 is just this 3, it takes out from all other elements this tree in all possible ways it can do it. It strips it off. So here's one way it can do it. Here's one way it can do it. It cannot do it here or here. Then such a map, which you can define by making everything linear and looking at linear combinations of things, you can now define as xi or acting on xk. And using Hochfeld closeness of this map, you can prove an extremely interesting recursion, namely that the sum of all terms in your perturbation theory at k loops, stripped off the I loops, is proportional precisely again to the sum of all terms in perturbation theory at a given degree, in this case k minus ii, with a very simple prefactor. Once you've proven this, you use this to prove another little lemma. Take the logarithmic derivative of the Green's function which you get when you evaluate all these Feynman graphs here by the Feynman roots of Marshall's Jacobi theory. Take the 1 minus the self-energy, so that's my definition of the 1pi Green's function in this case. It's the inverse propagator. Take the derivative of the log of the inverse propagator with respect to log q squared over mu squared. This is still an infinite series in two variables, log q squared over mu squared and your coupling. It has 2 degrees in it. You can decompose it into coefficients which tell you the degree in log and the degree in the coupling constant. It's a two variable series, and here you get, it fulfills the recursion. That's a term proportional to log q squared over mu squared to the nth power The term here contributing to alpha, to the nth power, is connected to this linear combination of things of lower degree in this fashion. So this recursion is easily solved starting from the trivial to calculate one loop diagram. And once you understand this recursion, you can actually completely solve your Dyson-Schwinger equation for this subclass of graphs, just using that B plus is a Hochschild 1 cocycle. So here's my inverse propagator as a function of these two variables. Its logarithmic derivative, and it fulfills a very interesting identity. Here I have a thing which still depends on alpha and q squared over mu squared, because I just took the derivative with respect to log q squared over mu squared, but have not yet set log q squared over mu squared to zero afterwards. Here I do this, which defines for me the anomalous dimension, which then is only a series in one variable a, but this variable a I replace by variable rho, which is the initial a over 1 minus sigma, so the propagator thing squared. So this gives me a relation between two series. Recursively solving this relation and just looking up these recursion relations, I realize that what I've proven is the following implicit equation over here. Square root of alpha over 2 pi is exponential of p0 squared times the complementary error function of p0, where p0 is the anomalous dimension of the series, plus 2 over square root of 2 alpha. So this completely determines the anomalous dimension as a series in alpha, or vice versa, if you want, and that's the definition of the complementary error function. So suddenly, you have summed a whole class of graphs by proving this recursion relation, and that utterly came from the fact that B plus was a Hochschild 1 cocycle, which allows you, amongst other things, to prove that the sum of all graphs in a given perturbative order allows for a coproduct structure on it, which is precisely then given you this lemma over there. So you are really getting interested in understanding these Hochschild 1 cocycles better, and we hope to repeat this game in general. And I will report on some progress over there in a minute. Just let me, for the record, give you the Hopf algebra structure on rooted trees. So my rooted trees are above here. The root is always, by convention, the uppermost vertex. Each rooted tree sits in a map which assigns a root to something else. B plus on 1 is just a root, and so on and so forth. BB plus equals 0 means that you can write the coproduct on rooted trees by simply defining what it is in composition with B plus. You make it Hochschild closed, and this defines the Hopf algebra structure on rooted trees, which you can also write in various other languages. Just as a side remark, in here you find your connection to diffeomorphism groups and so on, and to the normalization group, by just looking at the other thing you can play over here, namely growing a perturbative object instead of at the top, at the bottom, namely summing over all ways of adding one more leaf and edge. So this goes then to this, there's something missing, to these terms. If you define delta k to be the k-fold application of such a map, then these things form another little sub-Hopf algebra, which is the sub-Hopf algebra of diffeomorphisms, and that makes the connection to the normalization group regarded as something which drives diffeomorphisms of physical observables, and you can go to standard notion like beta functions and so on from there. So now, so what you want to understand a little bit better in this game is what is actually happening, say, in a full-fledged quantum field theory. What are the Hochschild closed one cocycles, and so on. So, okay, so what you are after is that you take a quantum field theory, you say, I'm looking at all one particle irreducible graphs, they are distinguished by whatever the external leg structure is, which I happen to denote some superscript R underbar, and certainly each infinite sum of the graphs with a given external leg structure is a linear combination of graphs at a given loop order, graded by that loop order, And the interesting thing you can prove with some work, if there are internal symmetries in your theory, is that your co-product here, delta on these linear combinations of all contributions to perturbation theory at a chosen degree, defines a Zapov algebra which allows for these linear combinations. And on the right-hand side, and here for polynomials in such linear combinations, on the left-hand side, now the total degree of this polynomial is j, and here is k minus j, so it's degree preserving, up, heading up to k over there. And here you get a polynomial in arbitrary external x-axis, because a given graph can have vertex and propagated subdivergences, and so on and so forth. This is rather easily proven and totally back-traceable to the structure of the Hochfeld cohomology of realistic renormalizable quantum field theory, as long as you do not have internal symmetries in your theory. What came as a big surprise in the last couple of months is realizing that this little hunt for these Zapov algebra structures, which then would also suggest methods to solve Dyson-Schwinger equations, know something just from the combinatorial aspect of these algebras about, for example, Slavnov-Taylor identities for the coupling. So what are the Slavnov-Taylor identities for the coupling? The Slavnov-Taylor identities for the coupling say quite a number of things when you work them out, but for the coupling here, the most important one for me at the moment is that the counter term for the vertex gluon goes into a fermion pair over the fermion propagator equals the counter term for the gluon into the ghost over the ghost propagator equals the counter term for the three gluon decay over the gluon propagator counter term, and here it turns out to come out when you work it through the four gluon decay over the three gluon decay, essentially taking into account that the four gluon vertex goes with g squared when you think about it. Now these are identities, and these identities you can, as a physicist, say, I just, in my mind, they simply mean I have relations between graphs. The precise statement would be, if I evaluate the counterterm character on those graphs, then these identities are true. But let's look at these Hopf algebra divided by these relations between graphs. You find a couple of very, very interesting things happening over here. First of all, these are all the graphs, just four of them, including symmetry factors, for the propagation of a gluon at one loop. So there's a half this graph, a half this graph, and those two other graphs where a fermion or a ghost runs around. Into these graphs, you can actually insert here, for example, let's say in these guys, there are two places to insert this vertex and two places to insert the propagator, which is 1 over this 1 pi Green function I defined. So this two places is reflected by the 2 over here. And now you can actually start looking at the Hochfeld cohomology over here. Insertion in this linear combination of graphs is precisely what is Hochfeld closed, this turns out. And each Feynman graph using this Hochfeld closedness at the end of the day allows you to replace the sum over all graphs precisely by the sum over these skeletons, which also figured as in the Beta-Zapeta kernel in a slightly different context, which Ivan had. So here the sum over all graphs is reduced to the sum over all graphs which are primitive in my Hopf algebra, so they don't have subdivergences. And here I have this map which insert into these primitive graph in all possible ways. I divide by the symmetry factor and so on. Now the game you play is you now want to show that this is Hochfeld closed. So you do these maps, you work them out, and Hochfeld closed this gives you constraints. So when you work it out all say to two loop order, you want to insert into this graph in all possible ways, all one loop graphs with these external leg structure into this graph, they can. The two here means you have two insertion places. The one here means there's just one such insertion place for all the graphs which have four external legs and just one propagator, and so on and so forth. You work this all out. First of all, you really create the sum of all two loop graphs divided by the symmetry factor, which is nice. And when you want this map B plus in the earth into these subgroups to be a Hof at one cocycle, you need precisely an identity, namely that this linear combination of graphs evaluates to the same as this linear combination of graphs evaluates to the same as this linear combination of graphs evaluates to the same as this linear combination of graphs, which is precisely what the Slavnov-Taylor identities for the counterterms, for the couplings, tell you to one loop order. And you can prove this to all loop orders. So suddenly, essentially out of nothing, you get at least the Slavnov-Taylor identities of a gauge symmetry just using the fact that you have a good algebraic description in these Hopf algebras of locality, which I find very satisfying because we are renormalizing a local gauge theory. These were only the Slavnov-Taylor identities for the coupling. There's still much more work to be done for the general Slavnov-Taylor identities, and which has something to do about longitudinal and transversal part and so on, and I'm working on that. In principle, the exercise must also be repeated for spontaneously broken gauge symmetries, which gives you much more graphs and much more skeleton graphs to consider, but this is ongoing. Yeah.
So I have the impression that there's one thing to write the identity down, I mean to postulate the identity.
Yes.
You can do that by postulating the identity
yes.
in the graph.
Yeah.
And there's another thing to prove that they actually hold. You know, that,
yeah.
You know, quantum field theory, you might write down identities that naive.
Yeah. Now here I just translate the combinatorical statements that they hold into a statement that I find a certain sub-Hopf algebra which would allow me to repeat this exercise and sum up graphs. Now this everything more than that now entails understanding the analytic consequences of applying the Feynman rules to this combinatorial object, and well, that is slow work, and we are working on that. So now, precisely coming to this slow work, now we certainly have seen that all these primitive skeleton graphs are very fascinating objects. They are certainly very fascinating objects from the viewpoint of randomization, in the sense they have no subdivergencies, so they just contribute a first order pole if you regulate your theory. This first order pole is completely invariant, universal, under relabeling any dimensional full parameter in your Feynman rules. So it defines what you can really call the residue of a graph. And certainly, once you understand the significance of these skeletons and the important role they play in understanding the structure of our theory, you would like to know what these residues are and how they evaluate. Now I must make a drastic simplification, because primitive graphs are most easily calculated in a scalar field theory like phi to the fourth. And once you have calculated them there, you can, because the same scalar integrals appear when you have gauge theories as just a bit more tensor structure in the numerator. But not very high loop numbers so far have been calculated in non-scalar theories. But David Brodess and I looked at precisely primitive graphs in phi to the fourth theory to a very, very high loop order. So the rest of my talk, I want just to spend a little bit of time summarizing what we have so far and what is a rather interesting connection to number theory, which comes from looking at precisely those graphs. So if I give you a little gadget like this one, those ones, let's start with the simplest one. Assume, let's say, you have a massless phi to the fourth theory or something, you're anyhow only interested in this residue over here, then this is really an integral we all can do. And this gives you just a rational residue. It's actually in suitable normalization. Each graph is divided by 2 pi to the loop number, 2 pi squared to the loop number, something like that. This gives you a rational number. There's nothing very interesting here. And these rational numbers are very well reflected in the topology of graphs. There is no primitive graph at 2 loops in phi to the 4th theory. The next one comes at 3 loops, the tetrahedron, 4 points, each point connected to each other point. That is subdivergence-free, primitive element, which drives the Dyson-Schwinger equations in phi to the fourth theory, and that has a residue.
Isn't the self-energy primitive?
No. The self-energy, there's this guy,
yeah,
which is highly divergent. It has plenty of subdivergencies.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh no, I mean it's primitive. Primitive in the sense of the co-product of the Hopf algebra. It has no subdivergent graph. So a graph in a Hopf algebra... Yes, in a Hopf algebra an element is called primitive.
Yeah.
If it does this. And this is what I'm speaking about. Not primitive, but primitively divergent in terms of power counting. Okay, so these are all primitive graphs here for the vertex. Yeah. I will precisely speak about that. Now, so this first guy here gives Q, and in other theories where we did the calculations, three things which are in a certain way which you can quantify in graph theory, free of crossing propagators, they just give rational numbers at the end of the day. But now let's look at some more complicated graphs. So these graphs have the structure. This is the first element that goes one thing up, and then it starts zigzagging around. And these zigzag graphs in fact of the fourth theory, you can calculate them. At some stage you only do it numerically, but for those you can go analytically quite far. They give you multiples. I haven't given you the rational multiples. Over here they are related to Catalan numbers, these rational coefficients. They just give residues, which are just single Riemann zetas. And that goes on quite far. I can actually play this game a little bit further, and you can actually prove, assuming I do the following. I give you one of those guys, and now I have to draw it right, I got. I do something which slices this, and then I give you something else, and do something which slices this again. This guy here precisely gives the zeta, whatever it was, of this subgraph times the zeta of this subgraph. So they give you product. These guys, for the moment it's two vertex reducible, it just gives you a product of the zetas of the two vertex irreducible components at the end of the day. So there's a nice, and that you can prove. So everything which has these properties, the residues just decompose into products of zeta. So that is something you learn. So what we did at the end of the day, using some heuristical connection between these multiple zeta values and knot theory, and a lot of numerical calculations, it was a lot of work done by David Brotas, essentially, on the numerical side, we calculated all residues, all 59 graphs, which have 14 edges, which have 7 loops, and also everything below, which was partly known in the literature already. Just let me not yet give you a 14-edge graph. Let me give you the first graph, which is really interesting. This graph is the most non-planar graph you can draw in phi to the fourth theory at 6 loops. So it has 12 edges. It is subdivergence-free. So it gives you a randomization group invariant contribution to your anomalous dimensions or whatever. And this graph involves actually the number U62 you saw yesterday in John's transparencies, or after some choosing another base for transcendental numbers, if you like, it gives the double sum zeta of 5.3. So the type of sums we are at the moment looking at are things like single Riemann zeta, 1 over n to something, are double sums, or multiple sums, and one smaller, sum nk, 1 over n1 to the s1, 1 over nk to the sk. I never get my conventions right because various collaborators have various different conventions, so this might just be zeta of s1 to sk, or zeta of sk to s1, or I might choose a smaller equal or something like that. But anyhow, these are very well studied sums in mathematics known as multiple zeta values, and it is true that for up to 12 edges, any known graph which in a renormalizable, even-dimensional quantum field theory has a residue, has a normalization group, invariant universal contribution, which is a rational multiple of such a number, or a linear, rational linear combination of such numbers, just by method of exhaustion, by computation. Ah, yeah, you can actually, You can also allow for alternating sums.
For example, I think,
and then you have,
at this level, you have relations between alternating sums and non-alternating sums, and there are various choices of bases you want to do over here, depending on who is calculating.
But you get these transcendental numbers up to 12 edges from such graphs. Now the interesting things happening are happening at 14 edges. Let me tell you a little story from mathematics why 14 edges are interesting.
Yeah.
This is precisely why I'm telling you now
at 14 edges, because at 14 edges the first hint for a counterexample occurs,
and that relates to interesting mathematics as well.
So there's a story about this graph.
Maxim Kontsevich, quite a while ago, looked at Feynman graphs and had the idea, coming from these experience
he had from computations, they must have something structurally to do
with this multiple data base,
and came out
at some talk he gave here in the US with a conjecture which he says
was motivated by this quantum field theory, that
field theory experience,
but was completely formulable as a problem in graph theory.
This conjecture said, when you look at the incidence matrix of a graph, look at the determinant of this matrix, you evaluate edge, you assign edge variables to each such edge, you look at these polynomials you get from the determinant, and you look at the zeros of these polynomials over various finite fields. He made a couple of statements about what are the properties of these polynomials, which were very baffling to combinatorialists and graph theorists.
So they sat down
and wrote a little computer code to check these statements up to graphs with 12 edges. That was as far as they could push their code. And they were always true. This conjecture was always verified. Wonderful. And Maxim always said, I believe that this conjecture is equivalent to the statement that in an even-dimensional renormalizer of a quantum field theory, the numbers you get are these type of multiple zeta values. Then came along Prakash Belkali and Patrick Brosnan, at the time PhD students by now, postdocs, who spent essentially their PhD thesis finding in algebraic geometry reasons for this conjecture. And they actually falsified it. They proved the existence of a finite graph with more than 12 edges, because up to 12 edges it was exhausted already. They don't know the edge number, but they proved the existence of a finite graph which will violate this conjecture. This does not necessarily entail that there must be a graph which is not in this number class, because we don't know if the conjecture that this conjecture of Kontsevich is equivalent to evaluation of graphs in multiple zeta values is correct, but it certainly gives a hint that something new might happening. Another hint that something new might happening came actually from the calculation of 14 edge graphs residues, which David brought us.
I do 7 loop graphs in phi to the fourth theory, which are primitive, because out of the 59 graphs we had, 56, after some hard work, we got them numerically.
We have
PSLQ,
which suggests certain linear combination of a given set of transcendental numbers, and then you improve your numerical accuracy, and then you still can describe the new numerical
result by this linear combination of transcendental numbers.
After a while, when you have a couple of 100 digits of accuracy
and it still works, you start believing you've identified your graph.
And sometimes when you've identified it, you can
back engineer and find
an analytic proof that it is
this multiple zeta value.
So 56 out of those
59 ones
are not a problem.
They are identified and they are always multiple zeta value. The 3 most non-planar graphs
at 14 edges, we have numerical values where no sensible
linear combination of multiple zeta values with rational coefficients,
avoiding huge primes in these rational coefficients, is able to describe this set of numbers,
this numerical result
we have for these graphs.
So we have
strong hints that something
non-multiple zeta value-ish
might happen.
The other way out would only be
that there are very, very freaky rational coefficients appear down there, which we don't believe
is the case.
So what you want to do at this very moment is you want to take these 3 14 edge graphs and have Stembridge algorithm, which tests Maxim's initial conjecture on graphs, running on those 14 graphs. This we tried,
David and I, quite some time, And there's, unfortunately, Stenbridge algorithm tells you if this graph is fulfills this conjecture, then the algorithm will terminate in a finite amount of time. And you don't know very well what that finite amount of time is. These three graphs with 14 edges, about a year of CPU time was not enough to make the algorithm terminate, which does not prove that this is not, but it's a strong hint in its own right. Okay, so we have these monsters out there. We probably do not know what they are. They are probably not multiple zeta values. Now, this all started, as you can imagine, interesting mathematicians. And what something which has recently happened is that Spencer Bloch visited the IGS regularly and got very fascinated by this phenomenon. In particular, Patrick Brosnan was his PhD student, so he sort of knew about this. And because I'm a complete apprentice in algebraic geometry, I don't know anything about algebraic geometry, essentially, and he knows very many things about algebraic geometry. And because I once showed him that the polylog and the whole structure of the polylog can also be derived from some recursive structure. Well, it's obvious the polylog is a recursive structure, which is very similar to these Hopf algebras and Feynman rules game which we are playing over here. We thought there must be a deep connection between algebraic geometry, number theory, and the phenomenon. So actually, we started working out if we can somehow understand a bit better why certain zeta values come from graphs. And at the moment, this collaboration, which was big fun for us and produced one first paper, is, I think, correctly summarized, we must admit, by saying we brought out big guns and big machinery and killed a mouse so far with it. In the sense that we can now show something highly non-trivial for a very, very, very simple class of graphs, namely the wheels with n spokes. These even don't belong to any self-respecting renormalized or quantum field theory. They just happen. Whatever the valence of these vertex is here, they just happen to be free of subdivergencies, so they give you in four dimensions a very interesting number. It will turn out to be again zeta of 2L minus 3 if L is a loop number of this graph, rational multiple of that. And that was our training ground. And we cannot do right now more than these class of numbers. But the way we do it is, so to speak, completely mathematical. So let me quickly describe a little bit what's going on over here, and that will finish the talk. So we got back to very, very old methods, which are actually very known, for example, to Ivan Todorov. So we did not apply any of the standard methods like Gegenbauer polynomial X-based techniques, methods of uniqueness, partial integration, or anything like that. We went back to the graph polynomial. So what is the graph? And you can go from the Feynman integral to the graph polynomial by Fringer parameters. It's already in its Zuber. It's a forgotten, elegant, and nice way of calculating the residue of the graph. So what you do is, you have a graph gamma. You determine all spanning trees of that graph gamma. Spanning tree is a connected thing. So it's and the tree, so it has no cycles, is connected and touches all vertices of the graph. That's a spanning tree in the graph. Then once you have identified a spanning tree T, you sum of all of them, you take all edges which do not belong to that chosen spanning tree from the graph and multiply all these edge variables which you have for each edge. That gives you the sum here. It gives you a polynomial, and you can show that if you want to integrate this polynomial from 0 to infinity and you cut it off by lambda, 1 over log lambda, limit lambda to infinity of the integral of this polynomial that
defines the residue, if you want,
of this graph, so that gives you the same number you would get from the Feynman rules for it.
That's all well known.
So now we have this nice little graph polynomial, and you can actually look at its properties. Here I gave you an example for the first non-trivial graph, which has three edges in it. This is view the three spokes. It has 16 terms here, your graph polynomial. When you look at it, it has a couple of interesting properties. It's linear
in each variable.
That's easy to understand. And what is very nice in it, and that's already non-trivial proof, is when you play the following game.
Because it's linear in each variable, there
are essentially two options you have. You either take the derivative with respect to some chosen variable A1, that you can graphically represent. The polynomial which comes upon taking this derivative is the polynomial, the graph polynomial of the graph, when you just open up and remove one edge
you add in here,
or you evaluate the graph polynomial where you set some variable
to zero.
Graphically, this corresponds shrinking this edge to a point. So if we now let psi lower something,
always meaning
that something shrinks, something is
set to zero,
and upper indices,
meaning
that derivatives are taken with respect to these variables, you can actually prove a very interesting property of this graph polynomial. Namely, you evaluate at both variables
at zero,
or take the derivative
with respect to both variables,
or start mixing
these two operations.
You take the difference between these two possibilities, and that is the square of a new polynomial, which itself is obviously a function of two less variables, and again is linear in each variable, and has all the defining properties which a graph polynomial also has, but unfortunately does not come from a graph,
single graph anymore.
Any of these ingredients comes from a graph, but not this polynomial
rho.
But still it lives
in a certain class of polynomials
which have certain properties. Now you can continue playing this game, taking more derivatives,
adding more values to zero,
for more and more, eliminating more
and more variables,
and you will realize,
at least for the class of the real graphs and spokes, you stay
in this class
of polynomials,
and that gives you a sequence of linear hypersurfaces in these graph polynomials, and you look at the zero set of these polynomials, which then allows by methods
which are probably very well known,
at least to one member of
the audience,
Noriko Yoi, allows actually, as we worked out in a rather lengthy and technical paper, to identify that these graphs,
for
motivic reasons, as
mathematicians
would tell us, so by pure thought, if you like, should give zeta of
2L minus 3.
What we would dearly like to
do is repeat this exercise
precisely for those graphs
which give multiple zeta values,
and precisely for those 14 edge graphs
which we believe do not give multiple zeta values.
There's a lot more
needed for that,
and this work gave us some idea what is mathematically needed and what can be done to proceed with that. But rather, right
at this very moment,
we just killed this little, rather
simple
mouse over here
using very
advanced algebraic
geometry methods,
of which I'm still an apprentice,
I would say.
But we have some hopefully good ideas
how eventually to settle the statement which numbers come from
quantum field theories, and maybe we are able to
show that there are really more than
these mixed state Hodge
motives, as they are called.
That's the end of my talk.